Okay, so I had just returned from a year overseas in Japan. Magical, transformative year. And my ex-girlfriend meets me at the airport. Ex because we decided that a full year apart, well, she's beautiful. Beautiful like Whitney Houston before the darkness, beautiful. Dressed in a white lace dress, pure. I thought of her every single day. And now finally she's wrapped tight against me, tight tears. I hug her, she kisses me. And I know, right then, I know that any reconciliation I may have hoped for, it's not going down because someone has happened. And I even know who. And I can barely breathe. But it's not the time, not yet. I've just arrived. There's a welcome home party that night at my homie's place. And my once girlfriend smiles. She's wearing something else exquisite. But I turn away from her, pulling me toward the dance floor. I see some of my crew. They're like, "Dude, you're back, man. It's about time, man. How was it, man?" It was amazing. "That's awesome, man. Awesome." And they're shoving shots of tequila in my hand. And I drink just like old times. Everybody whoops. They order another. I go outside and I sit on a car until some guy tells me to get off his car. I walk home. It's my welcome home party. And the next morning, I go to the Myers, a huge grocery store, and I feel like a ghost. Like everyone can see through me, like I'm watching my own life instead of living it. I stepped out for a year, but everyone else kept doing their thing. I don't know why this surprises me. My phone rings. It's my girlfriend, and I cannot pick that up. Whatever that conversation is going to take, I just don't have it yet. I'm staring at the phone, and it rings again. But this time, it's my buddy Ray. He'd been my next-door neighbor in Japan. We both returned to the U.S. at the same time, but he lives on the other side of Michigan. Funny Ray, confident Ray. I pick up, "Hey, hey." And Ray says, "Dude, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I'm kind of having a hard time getting back in the swing of things. Something's off." And hearing him say it, nothing was fixed. Nothing was better. There was no magic wand, but just hearing him say that, I knew it wasn't just me. Today, on Snap Judgment from WNYC, we proudly present Picking Up the Pieces. Amazing stories from real people pulling it all back together again. My name is Glenn Washington. Always remember and never forget. You can tell me anything because this is Snap Judgment. We're kicking off today's Snap Judgment episode in the middle of a rescue mission. Snap joins award-winning author, producer, journalist Jake Halpern and his new companions Josh and Lisa in real time right as they set off to save someone's life.
I can't believe this.
It's surreal.
We're doing this. This is happening.
Yep.
This is happening.
We're good.
0.8 miles. 30 years. 30 years. I had all these visions. I'll go up there. I'll knock on the door. I'll tell him what's what.
Oh, yeah.
I'll ask him where he was. I just want to see him before he's gone.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh my God, I'm going to puke it. Oh.
My hands are
throw
sweating
up all over
so.
This is Josh Flanagan and his sister Lisa Prouty. They're at the tail end of a 9-hour road trip from Buffalo, New York to Bloomington, Indiana. And they're about to see their dad, Michael, for the first time in decades.
I don't like it.
Can we turn around? This is his road. I'm turning onto his road.
Okay.
I'm turning onto my father's road.
All right, let's go.
32 years, I'm turning onto his road.
My hands are so sweaty, it's horrible.
Oh my God, is this it? That looks like it from the pictures.
I don't feel so good.
40 feet.
Oh,
oh my God, he's sitting outside.
Okay.
Oh my God, that's my father.
Lisa hasn't seen her father in about 20 years. Josh hasn't seen him since he was 5. A few years ago, Josh did track down his phone number. They even talked a few times, but not in person. Then, just recently, Josh had a feeling. He started to get worried that his dad might pass away or disappear, and Josh would never get to see him face to face. So he tracked him down again. He couldn't get his dad on the phone, but eventually he managed to reach a neighbor. And the neighbor had some shocking news. His dad, Michael, was living in his house without water or power, and he was on the verge of death. There was no one there to take care of him. Josh called his sister, Lisa. They got into the car, drove all the way to Bloomington, and arrived in the middle of a rainstorm.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, he looks like he's dying. He looks like he's dying.
Josh, that doesn't even look like
Whoops,
that.
I don't want that.
Flanagan? Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, I'm recording this. I want to record it. All right, bring it in.
Hi. Hi. I love you.
Wow.
Oh, this is wonderful. Hi.
I can't believe I'm standing in front of you.
Yeah, I know. Me either.
Well, I feel the same way.
And you look different than
you
I
look
thought.
Really different,
I don't know.
Yeah.
You're smaller than I thought.
Yeah.
In my memories, you were much taller than me.
Well, in your memories, I wore boots a lot.
Yeah, and I was 5, so.
You have to understand, I didn't know how I would feel when I saw you.
I do understand.
But
I just hate it that you come to my home after all this time, and I have practically nothing.
We didn't come to see.
It's
no, that's just not the point.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I understand how you must feel, but we had some ideas to kind of help out with you.
I'll tell you this. I never forgot how much I love you. Never. But I had a law. You don't take children away from their mothers.
Right.
Josh and Lisa weren't ready to start digging up the past with their dad. They were too busy looking around at the rundown house where Michael was living. There was no power, water, heat, or AC. Feral cats roamed in and out, and the smell of mildew and rotting food was overpowering.
Dad, you understand that, you know, pretty soon you can't stay here, right?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. So, because that's why we want to find you a place to live, so that we don't have to worry about you, okay?
Well, listen, you got to get some rest. I mean, I'd keep you here all night.
I know. It's okay. We're going to come see you in the morning.
Bring it in. Group hug.
Really?
Love you.
Bye, Dad.
I can't believe I'm going to pull away and leave him here, you know?
He's just itty-bitty. Why is he so tiny? Here?
I don't want to leave him there. I have a heart beating in my chest. He's another human being. And I really, really felt the connection to him. That's my dad. And I'm not saying he's earned that title, but it is my dad.
So, I mean, we'll see what we can do tomorrow. You know, probably what we'll just do is we'll do that in the morning.
Josh and Lisa haven't actually known each other for very long, just 2 months. They're two of Michael's 10 estranged children from 6 different marriages. Growing up, Josh and Lisa's only real connection to their father were the books of poetry that he had written. Other than this, it was mostly guessing about who this man was and why he wasn't there. When I talked to them that night, after they finally met their dad, they appear to be in a mild state of shock. They don't know what to do, or whether this man, whom they suddenly rediscovered, even deserves their help.
But it's like we have to choose now. Which side of this are we going to take?
Explain. I mean, this is a guy who's been absent from your lives, your entire lives. I mean, how...
You know what? There's nothing about this guy that I want to like, and I like them.
Yeah. You don't want to like him, but you can't help it. He's just this cute little old man. Looks like a little old fisherman guy.
30 plus years. There's no reason that we should not have had contact. If he would have called me at any time in those years, I would have talked to him.
Are you on the same page? Are you clear in your... Are you each clear in your own mind what you're prepared to do for him at this point?
It's tough. It's tough. I don't think he has any food. Like, I don't think he is eating. I don't think... I think that he was literally sitting there waiting to die. I don't have room to care for him because
I don't know him, and he's never done anything for me or cared for me or shown me anything. You know, the damage that's done not having a father figure. But there's no way you can look at any person and not feel for the fact that this person is penniless, homeless, and alone. And what do you do in that situation?
The next morning, I go with Josh and Lisa to the abandoned house where Michael is living. When we arrive, Michael is sitting on a plastic lawn chair out front. He has a bushy gray beard, and he's wearing a heavy plaid shirt and a White Sox cap. Michael seems overjoyed, though he's so frail that he has a hard time standing up to greet us.
Okay. This is Jake. Jake, this is Michael.
Nice to meet you, Michael.
Glad to meet you.
Can we go in the house for a few minutes?
Sure.
That'd be all right?
It'd be fine. In fact, I wanted to take you in.
Remember, there's no electricity, so the inside of Michael's house is dim and gloomy. Much of the place looks like a forgotten storage depot for an art gallery. Michael is a painter, poet, and sculptor. He was never famous or made much money from it, but he's devoted his entire life to his artwork. The walls are covered with Michael's paintings, and in the corners they're stacked a dozen deep. Some of Michael's pieces are strikingly beautiful, like a series of stones that he's painted with an iridescent enamel. Despite the squalor, the inside of the house is a wonderland of artistic creations.
Wow.
And there's another one.
Oh, my God. I, like, remember that.
Wow.
I remember that picture.
That's beautiful.
What's the story with this?
Let me tell you something. At least in my philosophy, art belongs to you until you finish it, and you let someone else see it, and it doesn't belong to you anymore.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, one of my great prides is my children, but I don't own them. I just tried to raise them.
I know there's been a period of separation between you and Josh and Lisa Marie. What's your hope for where things might go from here now that you've been...
They're already fine. There was never really a separation. It was just geographic and chronological. Those children and I loved each other from the day they were born. And decades later, when they came back, we loved each other just as much.
So, Michael, you clearly consider yourself to be a good father.
That's like asking water if it's wet. Yeah, I wasn't a perfect father, but that had more to do with my profession. I just didn't have a choice sometimes.
In the house, Josh and Lisa look around, mesmerized. It's as if they're both surprised, relieved, even a little joyful that something beautiful has come from their father's absence.
It's kind of amazing to me because in some ways the poetry is almost like a stand-in for him in some ways.
When he was absent and I could read that, I felt like he was talking to me.
That's what I found.
Who is that?
It's me and my mom. Jacqueline.
Yeah, she was kind of a hottie, huh?
Ew, Josh, ew.
Yeah, it's your mom, not mine. She was pretty. My mom said she was beautiful.
So... Six wives, though? What happened? How did why so many?
I'm no day at the beach.
I'll put it away so it doesn't get wrecked.
That's what happened. It's 4:00 in the morning. I'm still working. My wife comes downstairs and asks when I'm coming to bed. I look at her and say, I'm working. Never get in the way of the work. The rule always in my households was we do the work.
Michael always put his artwork first, before his kids, and yet the kids themselves appear in the poems. One of his poems is about Lisa, after her mother had taken her to California.
Michael, at some point, might I get you to read Gifts to Lisa Marie?
Of course.
Can you give me a little bit of a background before you read the poem of what inspired it or...
Never explain a poem.
Okay, fair enough.
Presents for Lisa Marie. One dozen pine cones, still green and just picked from the tree, and some although there'll probably be dust by the time they reach California. This is after her mother had taken her to California. Presents for Lisa Marie. A geography lesson, a bouquet of autumn from a place that still has seasons. A slap in the face to California's sameness and the distances between us, with no apologies or reasons save these two. I miss you so badly. I cannot bear to write or send the photographs you've asked for. Two, I'd slap the face of God if I thought he was what keeps me from you. But I don't blame God or anyone anymore. There'll be no autumn celebration this year for me. Celebrations are for free men. And I won't be that till I hold you in my arms again. It's autumn, Lisa. And I am like the tree. Love, Daddy.
Sorry, Daddy.
It's a tough one. Okay, if it's possible, don't forget my cigarettes. I'm going to have to figure out what I'm going to do next.
Well, we're going to go to the office. You were going to go change clothes.
Oh.
Right.
Josh and Lisa are on a particular mission, to get Michael someplace safe. But neither of them is willing to take him home. And it's not just because he was an absentee father. Both Josh and Lisa remember him being actually violent. Lisa told me in private about an incident seared into her memory from childhood.
I remember hearing all the noise in the apartment, and there's like banging of pots and pans and stuff. And then I ran out there, and he hit my mom in the head with the recorder, and I know it broke. And she was holding her head, and she told me to go back in my room. And I stood in the corner, and I heard him yell that if I didn't stop crying, that he was going to keep me. So I stopped crying. I was real quiet.
Josh and Lisa both tell me that confronting Michael about the past would sabotage their mission. Because if they did, Michael might become hostile and closed off. So they smile and nod, even as Michael continues to justify his absence in their lives with his own version of history.
In his mind, he's like world's greatest dad.
Yeah, he is quite convinced of that. That's true. I would like to note that even though I call him dad, I have a dad. Much of this is I need to get him to safety. You know, if I were to come in here and be business and not call him dad, he's not going anywhere.
I'm playing up the compassion a little bit to give him hope. There are parts of me that want to lash out at him, and I'm squashing those, and I'm being more affectionate than I might otherwise be.
But for right now, I just want him to be safe.
But I am.
He's
not
safe where he's living.
I think he wants to come home with us.
Well, I'm sure he does. You know, he
gives. He's not going to come to a head at some point, or.
Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
After some coaxing, Josh and Lisa manage to get Michael in the car, and they start driving around Bloomington looking for some place that will take him in. For the time being, Michael seems unworried about where we're going, and instead he regales me with stories about his younger days as an artist. He talks about palling around with Ginsberg and Kerouac.
Jack. And Kerouac said, "Stay pure, man. Always stay pure."
He talks about his poetry and the standing ovations he received at readings. It's hard to know what to believe. Over the course of the day at various social service organizations, Lisa tries her best to explain the urgency and the absurdity of her situation.
I don't really see... We'll try that entrance over there.
Do you think that he's still holding on to the hope that if he goes through the motions of all this, he'll somehow end up going back to Western New York with you guys?
I'm thinking that, yeah, I think that he has like a small hope of that. And I think he also is under the impression somehow or another I'm going to stay with him. Because he asked me in the house, he said if he could only ask me one thing, he'd ask if I stayed with him and if I'd just stay with him until he dies. Hi. We were just at the FSSA, and they said they're to take my father to the Bloomington Hospital and that there's also a nursing home there that they can put him in. This is exhausting, and we're getting nowhere.
Yeah.
In the end, it becomes apparent that the only real option is dropping Michael off at the city mission, which is basically the local homeless shelter. And as this possibility dawns on Michael, he looks fidgety, a little scared. He starts asking what the plan is.
I'm just curious about the facility I'm going to be at tonight.
Well, that's the mission that you talked to, right? That's the one?
Right.
That you had talked to with the neighbor about?
Todd?
Yeah.
Right, and I called them and talked to them twice.
As everyone gets back into the car to head to the city mission, the mood becomes tense. It's a late spring afternoon and heavy storm clouds have rolled in. For the first time all day, Michael is totally quiet. It's as if suddenly he's accepting the possibility that his children really might leave him. Minutes later, we're arriving at the city mission. It's a small place. There's a mess hall on the first floor with a few tiny windows. The floors are spotless. It feels like army barracks, except for a radio that's playing pop music.
Oh, I called earlier and they said we could check him in between 5 and 7.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Who are you checking in?
Our dad, Michael.
Oh, okay, sure, that's not a problem.
Thank you.
How you doing, Dad? My name's
Michael.
Al. I'm a chaplain here.
Oh, thank
I'm Michael.
You.
Pleased to meet you, Michael.
I'm Lisa.
Lisa, God bless you. Good
thank
to see you.
This is my Jake. Brother, Josh.
Josh.
Hello, Josh.
This is our friend, Jake.
I'm doing a story for National Public Radio.
Yeah. Oh, okay, for yeah. NPR. All right, good. Well, have you had any alcohol in the last 24 hours?
No.
Good. Okay. You passed first base. We got to still go to second and third, but you're okay. I'll need a picture ID.
Got it.
He's good.
And, and then we'll go from there.
Okay.
And this is his stuff.
Michael's the oldest guy there by a solid 20 years. The other residents look like hard cases, quiet,
here?
Sullen young men whose lives, for one reason or another, have hit rock bottom. At this point, Michael looks freaked out. The cockiness that he seemed to exude earlier in the day is entirely gone. He seems close to tears, and he keeps asking whether he's going to be able to walk around at night.
I mean, remember, this is the hard part.
Above all, he doesn't want to be locked in.
It's not difficult to be here unless you have a specific problem, you know.
I have a problem.
I understand
my
that.
Anxiety
yeah.
level.
Okay.
That I'm very claustrophobic, and if I'm shut mm-hmm. in someplace, I go nuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I hate to say this, but there is a possibility maybe this is not for him. It's a decision you're going to have to make. But
let me talk to him for a minute.
Yeah. Okay.
Come here, Dad.
My anxiety level. I feel it going nuts already.
I'm not positive he'll stay here tonight.
It's so clear he has a really high sense of himself and his importance in the world, and it's come to this, in this, like, homeless shelter in Bloomington, Indiana.
He doesn't want rules, he wants to be free, but if you want to be free, you have to be a responsible man and live your life in a way that you set yourself up for that in your later years. And that's clearly not the case here.
I just feel bad, but he'll be okay.
Finally, Michael agrees to stay, well, at least for one night. And so, after a lifetime of being abandoned by their dad, Josh and Lisa prepare to leave him, alone, in a tiny homeless shelter on the outskirts of town.
Okay. All right, you ready?
Love you.
We're very proud of you.
Yeah. Love my kids.
We love you too, Dad. Okay.
We'll talk soon.
Just as we leave, the clouds, which had steadily been getting darker, explode into a rainstorm. And so, when it finally comes time for us to go, Josh, Lisa, and I all have to bolt out the door and sprint for the car. It's impossible to see Michael or even the building that housed the city mission. It all just kind of vanished in a watery blur.
That story was produced by Jake Halpern, a production assistant from Anna Sussman and Anna Adlerstein. You can find out more about Jake Halpern at jakehalpern.com. And when Snap Judgment returns, someone gets a midnight phone call, but he is not who they think he is. When the Picking Up the Pieces episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Picking Up the Pieces episode. Today, instead of celebrating the triumph of success, we're exploring what happens on the other end of life's spectrum. What do we do when things don't look so good? Our next story comes to us from across the pond Snap Judgment's Davey Kim spoke with Mark Dowd.
So it's 1992, and I've had a really tough day at work. It's about 10 p.m. in the evening, and I get in, and my flatmate looked to me and said, Mark, I think you better sit down. Now, there's something you need to listen to. He put a bottle of whiskey and a glass next to the answering machine, and I just pressed the play button. And in about 30 seconds, a message was left for me from a relative, a man saying he was my uncle, telling that my father had died. For 10 minutes, I was just numb. And I had these images of my father passing through my mind, the things I hadn't said to him. I gulped the whiskey, and finally I dialed those numbers, expecting my tearful mother to pick the phone up.
Hello, Swinton 8199.
It was my father.
It's you. Is that our Mark? Are you all right, son? You don't half sound queer.
Well, my dad knew I was gay, but I guess he was using queer in the sense of sounding a bit flummoxed, a bit off balance.
What are you doing? It's 10:45. You don't normally ring this late. Are you in trouble?
No. I thought you... So I went through this pretense conversation for 10 minutes and limply ended up saying that I would call him later in the week. I thought, what was on that answer phone message? My father is not dead, but somebody's dead. But who? So I pressed the play button once more, and the second time round, listened much more intently to the contents of this message. And I picked up this name, Ronnie Craddock, who purported to be my uncle. And I thought to myself, Ronnie Craddock. The last name, Craddock. Ah! And it was like one of those flashbacks in the movies. Suddenly, I'm 18 years old. It's 1979. And at that time, I had a job in a furniture factory, carrying out all sorts of very complicated mechanical jobs, unsealing valves, stripping out bits of machinery. I was paired up with this guy called Bob Craddock. He was an older guy, small, wiry, muscly, divorcee. I understood he actually had a son in a previous relationship. Well, it was pretty clear after a week or two that Bob had taken a bit of a shine to me. He liked beer, I liked beer. I'd found a new friend. So we'd been in the job for 2 or 3 weeks, and then one day in the boiler room, absolutely out of nothing, Bob put the moves on me. He lunged towards me and just kissed me, really passionately. He was a macho, masculine guy, the least likely gay man you can ever imagine in the world. Ever since I'd been 13, 14, I'd been coming to terms with my sexuality, and I'd come out to my parents gently, but never in my wildest dreams did I think that my first serious relationship was going to be with a welder in a furniture factory. He kind of grew on me in the time in that factory. I mean, sure, he was older than me, but, you know, I was 17. I had a fairly difficult relationship with my own father, and here was somebody, well, old enough to be my own father, I guess. This guy had an embrace that was so kind of strong and so unconditional. That's why I think I began to fall in love with this guy. And so we began this intense relationship in the factory, a more dangerous place you can't imagine. For two gay men, we were surrounded by homophobic guys who looked at, you know, semi-naked pictures of women in the British tabloid newspapers. There was a lot of pressure there to conform. Things between us were fine for the first few weeks, but it began to become more and more difficult. I was frightened that everyone would find out, but he was so passionate that he didn't seem to take any of these concerns on board. One day, I just absolutely lost it. I just said to him, look, this has got to stop. And he exploded. We had this huge row in the factory. But I just flung my overalls on the floor and I said, Bob, stuff you. It's over. I was out of there, heading to the factory gates, slammed them shut.
I hopped onto this passing bus with some of the other workers from the factory, and we sped off. Peace and quiet at last. This lasted for about 5 minutes until suddenly there was a little jab in my ribs from a woman who I recognized in the factory. And she said, "Excuse me, love, I don't want to interrupt you, but there's a man in a car behind. I think he's trying to get your attention." And as I turned round at the back of the bus, I saw Bob in his metallic blue Ford Cortina, face practically pressed against the windscreen, driving like the clappers, trying to catch up with the bus. And I thought, oh, God, is there anything this man won't do just to get his own way? Suddenly, all the traffic surrounding the bus came to a halt. Bob had come alongside the bus and blocking all the oncoming traffic, drawing everybody's attention. He leans over to the passenger window and starts shouting out, "I love you, I love you, don't let it end like this. Just get off the bloody bus." And of course, all the passengers on the bus were looking at him and thinking, well, who's he talking to? Where is the big Swedish blonde who's the object of his attention? I'm now hiding behind my newspaper with my face burning like a tomato. And suddenly one man turned across sharply from his seat and pointed at me and said, "It's him! It's him! It's his mate! Bum chums!" They all began to bang on the floor, shouting out these abusive terms. I felt like a caged animal. So I had no choice. I just had to get off this bus and jump straight into the Cortina with Bob, who instantly slams in ABBA. And we just drove off. I said, "What have you just done?" And he was smiling. That worked, didn't it? We're back together. Worked. I said, "What do you mean? You've just outed us to the whole of the factory. What are we going to do tomorrow if we have to go back and work there? We're going to have to face an inquest." "Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Well, you better get thinking." You know, I hardly slept that night. I thought, how are we going to get over this? What are we going to do? And so at 7:30 the next morning, with our slow paces, I got towards the factory gates and instantly recognised several of the people who'd been on that bus. They were all waiting. I thought, oh, here we go. Here we go. But to my total amazement, they were all smiling. And they all came up and patted me on the back and said, "Hey, lad, oh, we're so sorry about what happened on the bus." What do you mean?" "We didn't know." Didn't know what?" And they pointed over to Bob, who was about 20 metres away. He just raised his hand in acknowledgement and smiled. "About you and your dad." "My dad?" "Yeah, well, he got in early. He's been telling us all. I mean, we knew he was divorced, and we knew he had a son, but we didn't know it was you. Well, it all makes sense now, doesn't it? I mean, all that I love you stuff from his car. I mean, you know, sorry, we thought you were a couple of, you know, them." I looked at Bob, and there was a smart look, and I straight over to him. I said, "What's all this about, Dad?" "Well, you knew I've got a lad, don't you?" "Well, I think you did mention that, but it's not me." "Well, it is now." Flash forward 13 years, back to the present, back to that voicemail message that had been left. That voice was from Ronnie Craddock. That was Bob's brother. I had no contact with Bob since we broke up 10, 11 years ago. It was a really messy, rather sour affair between us. And yet here he was, his brother, telling me that he was dead. Bob must have been in his 50s. I ring up Ronnie, the brother.
"Oh, lad, we've not seen you since you were 2 or 3. Not since your dad went off and broke up with your mother." "Oh, listen," he said, "I've been planning this funeral for Bob for Friday. For your dad. You won't be coming, won't you?"
"Well, hang on a minute. I'm not Bob's son. I'm just a really good friend. And,
No. You must be. When he died, we went to his flat. We found all the photos of the two of you on vacation together. I mean, everybody's got those photos. We found all your newspaper articles. He recorded all your television documentaries. He never stopped talking about you.
And all of a sudden, I just felt really guilty. I thought, you know, I couldn't reciprocate these feelings. This guy held me in his heart for all this time, and I almost felt as though I'd let him down. Now, at this stage, I could have outed Bob to his family, but he'd spent the whole of his life keeping this back from his family. Here was his brother grieving for the loss of Bob. I mean, who was I to put the cat amongst the pigeons at this point? And he got very serious and said,
"Look, I don't want my brother coming across as a liar. Think about it. There's an expectation that at least with Bob's death, we'll finally get to see his long-lost son. If you don't come, there's going to be a huge disappointment around here. You have to come."
So I took a long gulp and I said,
"Well, if it's just for this Friday, the funeral."
So the night before the funeral, I'm staying in Manchester where my parents live, and my dad says to me, "What are you doing in Manchester? There was that funny phone call the other night, and now, a few days later, you're here. What's going on?" "Well, it's a bit sad, really. I've got to go to a funeral tomorrow." "Well, who's died?" "Well, you won't remember him. He was a man I worked with in a furniture factory." "Oh," he said, "I remember that. He was the man who taught you to drive, wasn't it? Bob." "Yeah, yeah." "Oh, dear," he said. Well, where's the funeral?" "Just south of Manchester." "Oh, well, listen," he said, "I'm not doing anything. I'll come with you tomorrow for a bit of company." Can you imagine the prospect of my fake father in a coffin and my real father sitting next to me having absolutely no idea about the nature of this relationship? And I tried for the next few hours to persuade my father not to come. "No, absolutely not. When a man dies, you've got to pay your respects. That man was good to you. The least we can do is give him a good send-off. No, I'll be coming with you." The fact of the matter is, my dad knew I was gay. Fine. It's another thing for me to be having a relationship with a man who's passing himself off as my father. It would have wounded him. There would have been silence for days and days, and that's not something I could risk happening. So the morning of the funeral comes, and the first thing I do is I recruit my younger brother. He knows everything about my backstory. He's going to be the chaperone to my father. We get to the church and look round and saw that the seats at the front had been left vacant. And then Ronnie, Bob's brother, gently grabbed me by the arm and beckoning towards the seats at the front where the family would normally sit. And my father was looking at me very puzzled and blurted out, "What are we doing here? We're not the family." One or two people stared at him and I thought, "Oh, get me out of here." And just in the nick of time, a voice from the front, it was the priest, "Please open your hymnals. Let's sing Lord of All Hopefulness." The service itself is fine. Ronnie does a really nice, sincere tribute. But then the horror of the reception, where potentially it could all unravel. There's beer, there's wine, there's an opportunity for people to talk to one another spontaneously. So I turned to my father and I said, "Well, I think you better be getting away now." And he looked at me and said, "Hang on a minute, I'm feeling a bit peckish. Come on." He invited himself to the reception. The reception, it's completely weird. Even though it wasn't obvious to other people, we had all the welders, all the people who I remember from 12, 13 years ago. And then on the right, a few members of Manchester's gay community, one or two drag queens, very soberly and respectfully attired. This was the schizophrenia, if you like, of Bob's life. By day he was a macho welder, but by night he was Bacardi Bob. People who I don't recognise, who I've never met before in my life, are suddenly coming up to me and saying, "Oh, it's such a tragedy." He was very proud. He brought the photos around to our house, you know, one day. He told us all about your trip to Vienna. Well, you just smile and you move on. And out of the corner of my eye, I suddenly see two aunts suddenly coming towards me. They step forward. One of them puts their arm on mine and says, "You know, love, we were only saying to one another in the church. What? You do have your dad's eyes. And out of nowhere, the voice of my father. Oh, thank you very much. And they stared at him as thinking, who's that? They looked back for me to reassurance. And I shrugged my shoulders. Suddenly my father is pulled out of my grasp by my brother, who's then lurching him across to the other side of the room. Somehow we get through this reception. My brother and father go off in one car. I make my own way home. And in that journey back, I've got Bob's face and his voice right there with me. Recollections, the time we had together in the factory, the fun we had, the rows we had, those weird trips we made in his Mark III rusty blue Cortina. And how weird to think that this man, even though he's 6 feet under, is still exercising a huge influence, holding presence on my life. Many, many years later, I decided to write a screenplay, a film based on this story, and I'd changed the names of some of the characters, but the outline of the story was fairly clear. Maybe it was time to tell my father, honestly, who Bob really was. A few days after I had sent him the script in the post, I nervously ring home. I'm expecting my father to have understood the whole thing.
I've read your script. I was saying to your mother, I don't really get this story.
Suddenly the phone was seized by my mother.
Oh, your dad. I've read it. I know all about this. It's pure black comedy, isn't it? But he'll never get it. He just doesn't want to see it.
And that, I think, was his choice. He was staying inside a closet, and I guess that also includes me too. I never completely came out about this whole thing with my father. I just let sleeping dogs lie.
Big thanks to Mark Dowd for sharing your story with The Snap. We'll have a link to his article in The Guardian about this very story on our website, snapjudgment.org. When Snap Judgment returns, we're going to destroy Skynet before the Terminator can be sent back. When Snap Judgment, the Picking Up the Pieces episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Picking Up the Pieces episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and you know that sometimes the hardest challenges are those we do not see coming. Our next story, from writer Manuel Gonzalez, comes to us from the not-too-distant future, where people are people until they're not.
Everything looks great. Your vitals, everything. But there's something we need to tell you, and well, there's no easy way to put this.
Am I sick?
No. In fact, you can't get sick because, well, you're a robot.
Huh? A robot?
It's exciting, right? This is very exciting for us. We hope it's exciting for you, too.
He's been my doctor since I was a kid. Except, I guess I never was a kid. The doctor and the assistant open up my head, and I hold up a mirror so I could see it for myself. None of this seems entirely necessary. The assistant takes a slender metal poker and pokes inside, and pokes inside, and pokes inside.
See?
And this makes my arm move.
Watch this.
And this makes my foot stomp, makes my eyes blink, and blink, and blink.
Pretty cool, right?
He motions to the assistant for her to stop. But what about my parents?
Actors. And boy, good ones, wouldn't you say?
But that's not what I mean. What I mean is, what am I going to tell my parents? How am I going to explain this to my parents? It seems so earnest.
Of course they seemed earnest. They were very well-paid actors.
I look at him. I know I didn't say that out loud. He smiles.
Sorry. We're getting a readout. Right here, see?
His assistant shows me the computer screen, which is full of my thoughts. I think about thinking about thoughts, and a new line appears at the top of the screen. I think, oh my God. And a line, oh my God, appears on a screen. And then I think, without wanting to think it, but I'm not even plugged into anything. And that appears too. And I read that line, and the assistant points at the screen.
Wireless?
Can you shut that off?
Sure, sure, no problem.
But they don't. They run tests. They set me in a harness for the first test, which are invasive, centered around probes, removal of limbs, drawing of blood. Why is there blood? To test reactions, to test for humanness, to test my pain sensors. Or so the doctor's assistant explains, not to me, but to the doctor. She looks like a student or something. Maybe she's a grad student, part of a class.
Now, is this actual pain?
I scream.
Or is this right here, programming?
I rise.
You tell me.
But these tests, which are bad, are not the worst. They set me on a treadmill.
Just run as fast as you can, as long as you can.
But I'm not very fast, and I can't run very long. Next, they set me at a desk.
You'll have 2 hours to finish this written exam. There are math problems and logic problems mainly.
And when the 2 hours are up, she takes a booklet away, unfinished, not nearly finished, and flips through my answers and nods her head and shows them to the doctor, who nods his head. Then they give me wires and circuits and boards and ask me to build something out of these.
Maybe a computer of some kind, but really, whatever you want to build.
Go on.
Having no idea what to do with any of it and running out of time, I just start to connect things at random. The thing that I build, which isn't really a thing at all, it doesn't work. At the end of it all, I ask them, how did I do? They look at each other.
Fine. You're doing just fine. Don't worry.
I feel winded and I want to leave, to go back to my job. It's a temp job, and I'm not very important at it, but it's the only job I have. And I asked for the morning off, and now it's almost the end of the day, and I'm worried that they're going to fire me. The doctor smiles. He's been reading the screen.
Don't worry. We'll let them know. You'll be fine.
Then the assistant, she wheels a television set into the room. More testing? She smiles.
Just a TV.
She plugs it in and hands me a remote.
You can get just about any channel. Not Showtime, but all the others. And there are movies. Movies and video games. Just press this button here.
She points to the large yellow button on the remote control labeled Movies. Games.
Do whatever you like while we're gone.
Gone?
We have a meeting. About you. About the tests. It won't take more than an hour or so. And then we'll be back and we can talk about it, okay?
The assistant opens up the door for the doctor. And then the doctor, he turns to me.
Now don't you go on any kind of murderous death to humans rampage while we're gone.
This is a really funny joke, I guess. So I laugh too. Because what else can I do? And then they're gone.
Thank you very much, Robot, for sharing your story with Snap. That story was written by Manuel Gonzalez. We'll have a link to all that is Manuel and his work at snapjudgment.org. The Snap players were the robot, Pat Mesiti Miller, the doctor, Doug Cordell, the assistant, Eliza Smith. It was produced by Eliza Smith, the sound design by Leon Morimoto. This is not the news. In fact, could push Humpty Dumpty off the wall, and when all the king's horses and all the king's men show up, you could push them off the wall as well, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.